This week in the markets, the Grinch was seen on Lower Manhattan Wall Street, which sent investors fleeing into the safe haven assets. Well, Merry Christmas, Happy Holidays, everyone. Just 4 days until Christmas and one day until Hanukkah. Your host, Chris Walczak, back with you on this December 21st, Season 13, Episode 675 show. On the cusp of 2019, it's hard to believe, but Season 14 of Gold Seek Radio is just around the corner. Most of us are remembering our blessings and looking forward to our time with family and friends. You know, it was just a special year for this household. Our 5-year-old Sam now has a 5-month-old brother, Benjamin. So we're particularly thankful for the new addition. But there's always dark clouds on the horizon, including what appears to be the unavoidable federal government shutdown tonight. Friday night at midnight after the House adjourned, the Senate announced there was no deal and senators were given the green light to return home to their families. It's tough to think of a better guest to help us prepare for the challenges ahead in 2019 than Gerald Celente. Gerald Celente returns with 4 new key trends. Higher interest rates, oil prices, social unrest, and war rate high on his watch list. We outline some of the keys for everyone listening to help improve the odds of their survival. Then David Morgan, the silver investor, returns with his comments on gold and silver. Now that the party appears to be over for U.S. equities, it could be better days ahead for the precious metals. And our Q&A hotline, 641-715-3900. Followed by our mailbox number, 514049. Just call in if you'd like, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. You can cancel, delete, and re-record as many times as you like. 641-715-3900, mailbox number 514049. We'd like to field your questions and comments. And Robert Ian wraps up the show with his latest must-hear report. GoldSeek.com radio begins now with a market weather recap. Visibility was virtually unlimited over the precious metals sector this week, with gold closing at a fresh 6-month record high on the heels of dovish comments from the U.S. Fed. At Friday's closing bell, gold added 1.4%, $17 for the week, finishing at $12.58. Silver added just 6 cents, finishing at $14.70, while the XAU precious metal shares picked up a dollar, 1.5% higher, closing at $67.60. Black gold, though, fell 5.6%, $5.50, 11%, finishing at $45.59. That was a stunning drop. Palladium finished off $13, still strong at $11.58. And the Bitcoin ETF, though, stole the show, up 13%, half a dollar, finishing at $4.32. Congratulations to my regular listeners who bought up Ethereum at $80 and $90 on my Alpha Stocks and podcast comments. It soared to $120. On Thursday before settling in. That was a 50% move in just a few days. The top story moving the precious metals sector this week. Investors pushed gold to the highest point in months on news the Fed Chairman Jerome Powell increased the overnight lending rate by a quarter point. But forward guidance was surprisingly dovish, and that sent the CME Fed Funds futures contracts into a completely different gear, you might say. Currently, the numbers show very low probability of another rate hike through next year. This is a sea change event. Traders simply do not believe we'll see a rate hike. Very low probability next year. Following comments that we'd only see 2 rate hikes from Jerome Powell, Fed chairman, and that, of course, was one less than expected. Meanwhile, the rate hike was already factored into the market. Policymakers surprised investors with that dovish talk, dropping it from 3 to 2 rate hikes in 2019. But as I mentioned, the Fed funds futures aren't buying any of it. This may be due in part to the looming U.S. government shutdown, which is scheduled now in about 3 hours as of Friday night. The House adjourned and the Senate announced they had no deal, and that did not make investors happy. Uncertainty is not a plus for most markets unless you trade the VIX Volatility Index. Bottom line, precious metals and Bitcoin. Well, investors were clearly unnerved by the looming federal government shutdown, plus the backpedaling by the FOMC on rate hikes next year. Traders took this as a hint the U.S. economy is not as red hot as previously thought. Then there was the dollar weakness against the Japanese yen, which offers billions of dollars in retirement yen, an opportunity to jump off the sinking equities Titanic into the gold lifeboat. Investors have poured about $1.25 billion into the gold ETFs. That's the biggest inflows in quite some time. Another intriguing anecdote, CNBC's Mad Money host Jim Cramer noted he feels powerless after the Fed hike. He told investors, I quote, buy gold, there's a gold bull market. He likes Randgold. That's one of our favorites on the Alpha Stocks list. It might even make the list this week. He says it mirrors the price of the exchange-traded fund GLD. So it appears the precious metals investors may have a happy holidays, New Year's, and perhaps a solid 2019. Moving on to the Wall Street Report, ominous clouds loomed over the New York Stock Exchange this week. Investors continued to sell and book profits ahead of what appears to be an imminent U.S. government shutdown on Friday. At the closing bell on Wall Street, the Dow was off an astounding 1,655 points for the week. That's 7%, finishing just above 24,000. Meanwhile, the S&P 500 shed 183, 7%. Finishing at 2416, and the Nasdaq gave back 577 points, finishing at 6332. In related domestic news on Friday, the Commerce Department noted consumer spending ticked up faster than expected, exceeding personal income last month. Plus, the December consumer sentiment reading topped 98.3. That was much better than the 97.2 anticipated by economists. Third quarter gross domestic product increased 3.4% seasonally. U.S. shares bottom line. It was interesting that Mad Money's Jim Cramer noted the stock market seems just like 2007. We all know what happened after that ominous date. Two solid years of selling, and it took the coordinated efforts of the U.S. Treasury and the Fed and their colleagues just to save the global economy. He warned investors that they might, however, regret selling out of their stocks because once the chairman of the Fed recognizes he's made a mistake, they're likely to drop rates and reverse course, sending shares right back so fast. Interesting, so be scared of stocks turn to gold, but be afraid of selling. The USA Today Greed to Fear Index registered the most fearful reading I've seen in at least 5 years of watching that indicator. Much of the complacency and risk I've been noting in recent weeks has finally or is close to being wrung out of the markets. So with so many key trading desks now on holiday, I wouldn't be surprised to see capitulation as soon as early next week. That might provide some interesting bargain hunting opportunities. So subscribers, be sure to log in to your Alpha Stocks newsletter. Coming up after the break, more Gold Seek Radio.
Top trends researcher, publisher, of course, of the Trends Journal, who joins us today. Welcome back, Gerald Salente.
Thanks for having me on. You know, there's a number of things going on, of course. Everyone's interested in where the markets are going and the geopolitical front. The major issues to look at right now are three of them: interest rates, oil, and war. Those are the ones I would focus on, and particularly as an American, we don't get the international news. I know a lot about Stormy Daniels, but not a peep about Yemen.
So glad you brought this up, because I rarely read anything now online that was produced in the United States. I mean, I go to like Sputnik News and you name it. For instance, I just came across an article today noting that we had a fleet of ships entering the Black Sea because there's concern the Ukraine and Russia might actually cross sabers over that piece of terra firma there in the Crimea. Do you see anything of particular concern between those two states?
That's a good point that I overlooked. You're 100% right. And particularly with the anti-Russian sentiment in the United States. And by the way, they're even blaming now the uprisings in Brussels and in
Paris.
Brussels as well. There's Brussels and France, both uprisings now against the establishment.
The Yellow Vest.
Yellow Vest, right. But they're happening in Belgium as well as France. They're blaming it on the Russians.
This is absurd. They remind me of 50s and 60s Americana. They're just so busy trying to survive. God-fearing people. It reminds me of visiting my grandparents and my aunt and uncles when I was a kid. They're just everyday folks.
Well, you're 100% right. I mean, how about that Iraq war based on lies of weapons of mass destruction and ties to Al-Qaeda? But going back to the point you're making, yes, keep your eye on Ukraine, because the government is in very deep trouble. They're in an economic depression. And when all else fails, they take you to war. And so with the United States becoming more and more involved in Ukraine, as well as Germany and England, that could be another powder keg ready to explode.
But another thing that's had a lot of people worried, and I don't know if this is just woo-woo or if there's any meat, any substance here, automation, robotics, AI displacing workers in the middle class and the working classes. You know, we hear rhetoric surrounding it. There's a big narrative. But is there any truth here? For instance, we see Amazon opens up one of the first fully automated stores, maybe two or three people in the shop. The rest is mostly automated. Walmart bringing in floor sweeping and now scrubbing and mopping robots that are there as you shop. Innocuous, don't bother anyone. Greeters now at many Walmarts and Home Depot around the world are being replaced with faceless screens. For instance, we heard the same thing, you know, with the automobile was going to displace the whole world and, you know, the electric light bulb did away with gas lighting. I mean, is this just the next logical technological innovation that we're going to have to deal with, or is there a threat here?
It's one of our top trends for 2019. You know, the King James Bible, it says the meek shall inherit the earth. Blessed are the meek, they shall inherit the earth. Well, we have, blessed are the geeks, they have inherited the earth.
You just made a lot of friends.
That's what we're seeing. The geeks are taking over the world. I mean, look at, the people have become robots. Watch them. Watch them walk up and down the street, holding on to their handhelds. And look at, go to any restaurant. Look at people not interacting with each other, couples, both on their handhelds, and with little children, infants, glued to their screens. The whole world is becoming more robotic, and so is the human race. Another one of our top trends is Generation Z equals Generation Zero. These are people born between around roughly 1996 to 2010. That's all they know. And you look at the data, they'd rather connect on social media than connect on a human scale. So yes, we're going to see more and more robots taking over, and it ties into one of our other trends, and that's human waves. The migration and refugee trends that we're seeing now destabilizing countries around the world is just beginning. You have to put a number on it, as we believe. And here's the number. Go back 100 years ago. You know how many people were on the planet? Around 1.6 billion. In 100 years, we've added 6 billion more people. So you have people escaping their countries that are violent, corrupt, and no income. And they're going to do anything they can. You could add on to the ones that are leaving their nations because of civil wars going on, and other wars created by the United States and others that are destroying their country. So you're going to see a human wave of people moving out of their countries, and then you have the other element that you point on top of it, robotics taking more and more jobs. You're going to see a lot of social unrest developing. Again, what's going on with the yellow vests in France, maybe we could start calling that off with their heads 2.0.
The irony, that was the place of the guillotine, you know, the widowmaker. That's not to say there aren't some valid points that are being made. We've got to find a more constructive answer than violence here.
More constructive answer to and thinking for yourself is that we believe in self-sustaining economies. And what's really destroyed the United States is our loss of manufacturing. Only 12% of our GDP is from manufacturing. And they sold us out by selling our jobs out to overseas with NAFTA and the World Trade Organization deal bringing in China. You go back to 1994 before Bill Clinton gave us NAFTA and our trade surplus we had with Japan, with Mexico, for example, not a $71 billion trade deficit. You go back to when Bill Clinton brought China into the World Trade Organization. China was basically, you know, a third world nation. 5% of their population back then when they joined the World Trade Organization in 2001 was middle class. Today, over 35% of it is. So what we believe is a self-sustaining economy is what could save America. You know, people talk about buying local, how wonderful it is. How about buying national? 96% of all the clothing and shoes that we wear are made overseas. It wasn't like that in the 1990s. So to us, the only thing that could save this country are jobs that create middle-class wages so people can have middle-class lives, and we've lost that. I mentioned to you earlier that 32% of college graduates have jobs that you don't need any college education for. So there are ways of changing this, and we believe a self-sustaining economy is one of them.
We agree with the Trends Journal. Self-sustainability on the local level, in the regional level, on the national level, absolutely essential. And even at the home base, you know, right there at the dinner table, self-sustainability, whether it be, you know, growing some vegetables in the backyard, part-time jobs, home-based entrepreneurial ideas. This is going to be central to surviving the economic Armageddon. The primary thing that we're hearing from you and many of our other top pundits here on the show, start prepping now. Get ready, because things just aren't going to be stable much longer.
Yes. One of the things that I keep saying is that prepare for the worst. If the worst happens and you're not prepared, you can lose everything. If the worst doesn't happen and you're prepared, you lose nothing. And gold, of course, is still the ultimate safe haven asset. I do not give financial advice. I want to make that very clear. But I really believe in having, only speaking for myself, at least 10% of the assets in gold. It's the ultimate safe haven asset. And in a time of great uncertainty, we see it all the time. When the markets start to rumble, when war drums start to beat, gold prices move higher.
Now that we're virtually 70% off the peak, other assets have gone ballistic. I could be an advocate of 15, 20% increasing your allocation. Yes, of course, that's our key focus here. So, you know, I'm biased, but still nothing wrong with that from a methodical investment standpoint.
The same thing with an individual. You get to a level of obesity and then you can't handle it anymore, and then you explode or collapse.
That's another one of your trends. It's a great segue into the next topic I wanted to discuss, because, you know, you brought to my attention and many of our listeners here the importance of self-defense, some type of personal security, because what you learn very quickly, you're usually attacked from behind. You have very little notice. By the time you go to grab the weapon, you're on the ground and the guy has you in a death hold. In other words, the bad guys, they don't tend to telegraph their intentions on what they're going to do. It's an explosive, dangerous situation. Your methodology is the only one that works. But a component to being self-reliant and having a good self-defense is being healthy. And this is a problem that you talk about. This is one of the trends, as I wanted to get to. I know it was a kind of circuitous route that's plagued my family. I've had to work on it. I've found intermittent fasting to be of incredible use. I've shed 20, 30 pounds over the last 6 months. It's super easy. Tell us more about the importance of staying fit.
The problem of obesity, it's even a bottom line problem. For example, in America, you have 180.5 million Americans, which is over 60% of the nation's population ages 2 and over, are either obese or overweight. And among the 70% of adults who are overweight, 40% of them are obese. Now, you compare that number to when I was a young guy back in the 1960s, it was just 3.4%. So people could talk all they want about fat pride and saying that, you know, there's nothing wrong with being overweight and that it doesn't equal unhealthy. However, that's not true, because they just came out actually with a study from the Milken Institute, and it shows, talks about the obesity crisis, and it's accounting for, according to them, $480 billion in direct health care costs in the United States, with an additional $1.24 trillion in indirect costs due to lost economic productivity. So we're looking at the total cost of chronic diseases due to obesity and overweight is at $1.72 trillion, which is equivalent to over 9% of the U.S. GDP. So chronic disease in the U.S. is also accounting for the total, about 47% of the total cost of chronic disease nationwide.
We don't want to disenfranchise any of our folks who have struggled with weight issues. There, although, you know, we're responsible for our own lives, I think there should be some discussion, some narrative on the injection of sucrose and corn syrup and so many of these sugars, chemicals into virtually every aspect of our lives. So a few little points that I've gleaned over the years. Number one, never drink your calories. In other words, if you're fighting the battle of the bulge, do not drink anything that's fattening, okay, because that's what we tend to turn to first. You down a big thing of chocolate milk or whatever your poison is. We want to make sure everyone picks up a copy of the Trends Journal and signs up. Can you tell us a little bit more?
Sure. The Trends Journal is a monthly. It's only $129 a year. Money back guaranteed. The only place you'll read history before it happens. And we put out trend alerts each week. And we have Trends in the News broadcasts every Monday through Thursday. It's trendsjournal.com, trendsjournal.com. You'll get tomorrow's trends today.
The ultimate evolution in print media. Boom. There we go. That's a soundbite for Trends Journal right there. Gerald Celente, we appreciate it. And if we don't talk again, of course, happy holidays to the Celente household.
And thank you, and happy holidays to you, and happy New Year.
Thanks for choosing GoldSeek.com Radio as a trusted business and investing news source. Today's featured guest, David Morgan, the Silver Investor. David Morgan pens the Morgan Report, covers economic news, topicality, financial health, global economy. Welcome back, David Morgan.
Well, thank you, Chris.
Investors were lured into complacency. Of course, I'm referring to U.S. equities, 10-year run, and the typical buy-the-dip strategy not working out the way it did in recent years.
We're overdue for a correction in the stock market. Right now, we're basically at the correction level, which means about a 10% from the top. But we don't really consider we're in a bear market from the establishment perspective until we have a 20% correction, and we aren't there yet, or 20% fall from the top. I do believe we're going to get there. And I mean, the Fed isn't really that proactive. They're usually followers, not leaders. They basically wait for markets and then they take action. So we're, you know, the camp that the stock market's on its way down, which is good for gold. Gold is the most negatively correlated asset to the stock market. Starting to show some strength here. I think 2019 will be a better year. I know I said that last year, but I really think we've got more going for us now. When you see the dollar, if the dollar starts to come off as well, and the stock market, and of course there's problems in the bond market with interest rates going higher, I mean, everything now is basically playing in the gold market.
It's interesting you'd mention that, because on the weekend, portfolio candidates for the Alpha Stocks newsletter, I ran through several different time ranges on the U.S. Treasury, bills, notes, you name it, even the ETFs, the TLT, SHY. U.S. Treasuries are not behaving, I think, as the traditional safe haven. The longer term's not buying it. That's something I don't think we maybe have seen in decades. If the theme persists, most investors are going to be caught flat-footed because, again, we started off with the complacency in U.S. equities. Traditional safe haven for the typical investor was always bonds. You know, one zigs, the other zags. But there are times when that correlation doesn't hold and precious metals fill the void.
And I agree that if you go back, you know, when I was a youngster, you go back 30 years, go back 30, 40 years, the bond market basically was more or less a free market. The bond, what we call bond vigilantes, they were the smartest guys in the street, the smartest traders ever, the bond traders. Well, whoever coined the term, and I give them credit, I can't remember, there are no markets, just manipulations. I mean, that's pretty much true now. Everything that's traded is basically done through some type of algorithm with some computer finding someone else's computer. I mean, yes, there's orders given by, you know, Chris calls up or does an E-Trade account and presses his mouse and buys a stock or sells a stock or trades an option or an ETF. Yes, that, of course, that takes place. But the real trading, the bulk of it, is basically, I won't use manipulation, but algorithms. So the point I want to make is, can we be in a place where, as you suggest, we see the bond market actually go the way a free market would react? So when the economy is uncertain, the currency is degrading, that the yield starts to reflect everything that's happening in the economy, and we're starting to see that, as you point out. Now, whether or not the banks will give up control of the bond market, it remains to be determined because, as we all know, banks can print money at will. And because of that fact, they pretty much have control of the bond market at this time. Doesn't mean, though, all manipulations end. And I'm certain that at some point this will end, whether by design or not. Things are going to shift drastically in the future. How it's going to unravel, I don't think anyone of us knows exactly. But as Bill Holter points out continuously, and I agree, it's the debt markets, the credit markets. Everything runs on credit. And when that freezes up, as Jim Rickards has called it, Ice Nine with Kurt Vonnegut, when that freeze to the credit system happens, then you're going to have a lot of displacements literally within a few weeks. And these are things that will or will not be overcome.
As you say, this idea of Ice Nine, the freeze up, the sudden and unexpected freeze, it's systemic, it's throughout the entire system. Virtually no one prepares for it, and everything just shuts down. Again, this has been the mantra of the diehard precious metals aficionados for decades, and it looks like we might have that freeze up at some point. What might cause that? And one thing comes to mind. You brought up the idea, not manipulation, but algorithms, and you can see that. Pull up a monthly chart of the S&P 500, the Dow Jones Industrials, or the NASDAQ. If you look at a monthly chart, you can see that there is obviously for decades, but especially in the last 10 or 15 years, if it's not manipulation, there's some other invisible hand at play. Collapse of General Electric. This is probably the only remaining primary component of the Dow 30. When I think GE, I think of my grandfather and great-grandfather's portfolios. You know, it's just like, they drank the debt Kool-Aid, and it sunk the ship. Tens of billions of dollars of their own shares using what? Cheap, free money. Debt. The free money train is gone. Thanks, let's say, to the Federal Reserve, which is bumping up rates another three or four times in 2019.
You know, there's an adage that as GM goes, so goes the country. Well, GM is, there's a recent article out there called Carmageddon. And Carmageddon is a takeoff, obviously, on Armageddon. It talks about the situation with GM, which is similar to GE. Now, these stalwarts are failing because of the debt problem. And that's just a metaphor for the larger picture, which would be the U.S., which is a subset of the global economy. So this is going to be a huge shift. It's going to be felt by nearly everyone. And it's really an unknown as far as how it will not only unravel, but what the repercussions will be. I think there'll be some places where not much changes, and there'll be other areas that will be drastically changed. But as you said, with, you know, Rickard's call on the Ice Nine metaphor, it's pervasive. It's ubiquitous. It hits everything. And that's what happened in 2008. Actually, we were starting to get an Ice Nine event. And as a metaphor, the Fed came in with a flamethrower and started to melt some of the ice and gave Bank A and Bank B treasury bills or notes, basically short-term debt, for their toxic waste that the other banks were not willing to trade anymore. So there was a freeze-up. They weren't willing. Banks were actually not willing to trade with you. And so the Fed came in and did what they did, which is they took and gave them something that everyone trusts. Well, when that happens again, and it's the Treasury market that isn't trusted or is being sold off, and the the buyer of last resort, the Fed steps in. Players that know what's really happening, as they refer to bond vigilantes, or a more awake public sees what's really going on and the currency's being destroyed, then, who knows where it's going to lead. I mean, these things have happened in the past. Wealth doesn't go away. Everything gets repriced. All the malinvestment, or most of it, gets wiped away, and there's a resettlement structure. And sometimes that's also done with a new currency at the same time or nearly at the same time. Basically, look at Bretton Woods after World War II. So we have some very challenging times ahead, but there's a lot of opportunity ahead as well. And I think it's something to be aware of, be educated on, but don't stress too much about it because, as I said, even in the 30s, as bad as they were, there were opportunities there as well. And if you're actually living within your means and have low debt, have some savings, have maybe 10% of the precious metals, you are far ahead of almost anybody else.
We might be approaching a time, most of my guests seem to agree now, where you can bump that up a little, 15, 20% or more, simply because of the discounts we've had over the last decades during this equities rally. The only free lunches for the typical investor because, you know, like an insurance policy, that you don't have monthly premiums because of the negative beta relative to U.S. equities. What do they have to thaw these markets? They could manipulate rates, right? And also their ability to purchase up mortgage-backed securities, you know, collateralized debt obligations and all the rest of this toxic debt. The buyer of last resort, which used to be China and a few other nations, there does not seem to be a lot of interest worldwide for our debt all of a sudden. To me, this is a sea change event. It's as though the buyer of last resort is now the Federal Reserve from a historical perspective. That doesn't bode well. Look at Venezuela. Look at Argentina on the cusp of runaway inflation as well.
If you go into the Venezuela, Zimbabwe, or any of these are basically not mature capital markets, nor were they the reserve currency of the world. And yet what we look at is the safest investment available is U.S. Treasuries. But that's a fiction, but that's still the belief. So the bond market or the debt markets are basically a governor on the entire system because of the interest rate. So when interest rates are going higher because of uncertainty and they're not sure what the dollar is going to be worth in the future, so the interest rates a la Paul Volcker is an extreme case. You push the interest rates higher and higher, the market does, because I don't know what that dollar is going to be worth 5 years, 10 years, or 30 years from now, so I demand this kind of an interest rate. That's what the bond vigilantes used to do. So as interest rates go higher, bonds go lower. So that means there's a lot of debt that's reduced in value, and that's a deflationary event. So you can be in a situation where you have like a high interest rate in Venezuela, but there's really no mature bond market. But if you have an extremely high interest rate on U.S. treasuries or bonds or notes, you have a governing factor that you've taken a lot of money out of the system. So because of that fact, I always believed that you would see higher and higher inflation. Not technically a hyperinflation, but enough of an inflation where you would be in a situation where the collapse happens without necessarily going to these high extremes that you see in Venezuela or Zimbabwe. It's just that, look, if the food prices and energy prices doubled overnight in the U.S., where would we be? When I was youngster, the COLA, cost of living adjustment, took place throughout all of the working class pretty much. This time it's not. There's too much competition in China. I'm not sure it could, adjusting as we think it through on both possibilities. So I think what you'll see is edging higher of prices, not commensurate with an increase in wages. Basically, people get starved out. And any time you have more debt than you can service, which is, of course, the United States itself, and that's a metaphor for basically everyone that works for a living, you're going to see a lot of things change. So, as I said, if you double the price of gasoline and you double the price of food.
I think we're seeing that already play out right now in Paris, France. I mean, look at Macron's nightmare. What sparked it? Certainly point the finger at accelerating food prices throughout history and, of course, limited job opportunities as key underlying attributes of social unrest. Well, what sparked it in Paris? It was a 20-cent increase in the price of petrol. And of course, it's already $6 or $7 a gallon, so it's obviously very expensive. People just can't make ends meet, and I think you alluded to that. Again, we don't want to get too dystopian here, so let's move on to some solutions. Are you still a believer that diversification is another one of those free lunches? And if so, should people be lightening up on any particular sectors and looking at anything else?
Well, during a stock market, you know, run like we've had, I mean, this expansion of 9 years or so, I mean, there's always rotation in the market. I mean, you look at what started in, you know, from the bottom in 2008, and here we are 2018, 10 years later. I mean, the, you know, FANG phenomena was sort of like the, pretty much a good indicator to me that we're getting near the top, because once you have these stocks that no one can go wrong on, everybody loves them. The solutions are, as I said before, very simple from that. To live within your means, have low or no debt, have some savings. Doesn't have to be all in, crypto or gold or cash. It should be a balance of what works for you. And just kind of be prepared. I think the main thing is be prepared mentally and know that, you know, the times we live in, without stressing too much about it, just accept it. And as I said, you know, if you're in a safe area and, let's say a lower population density, you know, maybe this thing will blow over for you and not really affect you very much. I don't really know. As I said, every case is different in different parts of the country, different parts of the world will have a different reaction. But if you're in a high concentrated area population-wise that's really dependent on, you know, those ships coming into port and you're getting your food trucked into your, you know, local grocery store on a, you know, 8 hour, you know, three times a day, and there's a disruption, you're in, you know, you're far more jeopardy than you would be if you're in a situation where, you know, you get your shelves replaced on a weekly basis or whatever. So we'll just have to wait and see. I mean, I don't like the doomer thing. I mean, if you look back to my beginning when I started on the internet and I wrote the 10 rules of silver investing, rule number one, no one wants to be a prophet of doom. You know, I mean, that's the first sentence I wrote. But there are times in monetary history where you need to be prepared. And this is one of those times. So being prepared doesn't mean you have to be an extremist. Nonetheless, you don't want to, you know, sugarcoat it either. You just want to be, you know, awake and aware. And look at your own individual case. Make sure you have got, you know, what you need. And unfortunately, too many people are but the old story where the grasshopper or whatever is doing their thing and the other insect isn't. They're just waiting. And all of a sudden, the one that did the work and stored food and prepared for the future was much better off, because things do happen throughout history. Not that often, but they repeat. And this is why you have to be aware of where we are. I'll add one more thing. I'll turn it back to you, Chris. But if you read Collapse of Complex Societies, John Tietner or something like that, great book, read it, and he went through the Byzantine Empire, Mesopotamia, and then all these empires and how they collapsed. And there's different arguments, monetary system, food, weather, war, lots of things that happen in these different societies. And the main thing that I got out of the book was one that can happen in many different ways. But I want it to sound, I don't care if it sounds profound or not. It sounds very simplistic, but it was a profound moment for me after I thought about it. So it doesn't really matter in a way what starts the empire to collapse. Once it starts down, it doesn't come back. And so this thing in France that may spread through Europe, and you see pressure in the UK as well with the Brexit. I mean, those two dominoes may just be two that hit the four, that hit the eight, that hit the 16. We may be witnessing right now the collapses really taking place without really realizing we're witnessing the collapses.
So I want to wish you a very happy New Year.
Thanks for having me.
Axel Merck, President and Chief Investment Officer of Merck Investments, Manager of the Merck Fund, and innovator in gold and currency investing. Welcome back, Axel Merck.
Great to be with you.
It's great to have you with us. And start off today with the Merck Charity Event run in North Carolina. This is a worthwhile event, and you were gracious enough to invite us. Can you tell us more, please?
Sure. Some of you may know Mark Yusko. He's active on Twitter. He manages money as well. And I teased him on Twitter because he does a lot of talking there. And it says, well, can you walk the talk? Can you run for the money? Basically, I challenged him for a run. And then what came of it is we will do an investment conference. It's more like a discussion, a small group in Chapel Hill, North Carolina on October 20th, that's Saturday. Talk about all the wonderful things happening in the world, the sort of things we talk on your show, about the things you can do possibly in your portfolio. Have dinner. And then those who dare run the next morning. And it's a half marathon or a 5 miler, and you don't have to run. But the point is that we get together, have a fun time, and yes, we do also do a little bit of a fundraiser with it. And if you want to know more about it, get in touch with me. You can also go to a link, merckinvestments.com/walkthetalk. And if you want to donate money, merckinvestments.com/fightcancer.
The talk is it not free to the public?
We don't charge. This is, and it's also, it's not a sales pitch type of conference. This is really to have a good time. And part of the reason I'm going out to North Carolina is because my daughter goes to school there. So I needed to have an excuse to get there for the weekend. Since my daughter loves daddy but doesn't want to spend 24 hours with him, I said, hey, why don't we combine some good with it? And so I felt, by the way, I've had discussions around the country in different formats. We used to call them currency roundtables. They focus on currencies and talk about the global threats and opportunities and so forth. And so this is really an opportunity to engage with another active mind in the market, that's Mark and myself. And so those who are able to travel to North Carolina, beautiful North Carolina, by all means, please, it's not too late to register. Get in touch with me, and I'll give you the details. And, yeah, there's no charge. We have a wonderful afternoon of discussion, dinner, and if you don't eat too much, we can go running in the morning.
So I want to encourage some of the folks who've reached out to me via email over the many years we've been on, Atlanta listeners, plenty of Asheville listeners, Greenville listeners, Raleigh, and Charlotte. This is all within your purview. So you're certainly going to want to bookmark the 20th. It is free of charge, and tell them that we sent you. Let's move on to the markets. Obviously, we had the Fed recently raise rates again. They will again in December. Are you watching this yield curve, the flattening yield curve? Do you have any concerns about an inversion perhaps next year? And what might be the implications?
So let's talk about the yield curve. Obviously, the relationship between the short end and the long end of the yield curve, a lot has been said about it potentially inverting. And by the way, it has been steepening a little bit in recent days, and that's mostly because the long end of the yield curve has sold off, and that's called a bear steepening. And so there is no guarantee, so to speak, that just because of a 25 basis point, 0.25% rate hike, we're going to have a yield curve inversion. There's a lot being said that, hey, every recession is preceded by a yield curve inversion. And the only thing I'd like to caution is there have been some false signals in that. Obviously, at some point you have it, a recession after yield curve inversion, but it doesn't always happen right away. And it, very importantly, though, the mandate of the Fed, even though one or two Fed officials have almost implied it, the Fed's mandate is not to prevent the yield curve from inverting. The Fed has multiple mandates, the best known one obviously to maintain what they claim to be price stability. But the very reason why the Fed might hike short-term rates and does induce a yield curve inversion is because they need to take the foot off the accelerator, because they need to apply the brakes. And if you give me a chance, I'll go into more depth as to why I believe that's going to happen this time. And they're not going to stop if and when the yield curve does invert. Think about where we are. We are at an unemployment rate that's the lowest since the late 60s. We have an economic stimulus in place. We have consumer confidence at all-time highs. We have inflation hovering, at least as government indicators suggest, around 2%. And then we have a Federal Reserve that says it's quote-unquote data-dependent, although Mr. Powell, by the way, unlike his predecessor, actually says what that means a little bit more. But importantly, Powell is a lawyer. He does not have a monetary agenda. Bernanke was a student of the Great Depression. Yellen was a labor economist. Powell is a lawyer. He's a smart guy. What does a lawyer who is smart do? He listens to opinions. He calls the committees. And that all of that takes time. That means he'll be slow in reacting. Powell has recently said is they can afford to wait to be before they're too aggressive because inflation expectations are well anchored. So he talks about inflation expectations being well anchored. Now that's, I hope I don't put all your audience to sleep, but that is Fed talk for suggesting that even if inflation goes a little bit high, the market, the public will trust the Fed to do the right thing. Now you may agree or disagree with that, but the point being is, All of that suggests, if you look at it from investor's point of view, the Federal Reserve will wait until inflation is a little bit too high for the comfort zone of the Fed. They will not act preemptively. In the 1990s, for example, Greenspan, he's a preemptive guy. He had his crystal ball, and he predicted something is going to happen, and he would go for it. Powell is not that sort of person. Powell is going to be slow. And so if you think about economic stimulus, very low employment, and you can argue how many people will come from the sidelines, but it means as long as the market can bear it and you don't see warning signs pretty much screaming from the sidelines, he'll let this economy run. Now, he will continue to hike rates a little bit, but this economic cycle will die of the same death as many economic cycles, that raising too much. And he is not going to somehow now stop and say, hey, this is the end of it. So he'll continue. And to just add one thing, the one thing that the Fed has been monitoring, I think, the most isn't so much inflation or this or that. It is financial conditions. Now, financial conditions is, again, one of these buzzwords, and different people have different definitions of it. The short of it is the availability of credit. So in 2008, you couldn't get a loan, at least late in 2008. Nowadays, even with the rate hikes we have seen, credit is abundantly available even for the junk sector, for folks who don't have good credit. Some people are saying, hey, the moment the market crashes or the moment the S&P goes down, the Fed is going to come to the rescue. That happened in 2008 and thereafter because it was the same thing. The market fell because credit was tight. The last time this happened is when in early 2016, when the fracking industry had trouble. Now, when we've had these hiccups in the markets, credit is still easily available. And so what that means, to translate it to plain English, is that the Fed will be happily marching with a rate hike probably every other meeting. The rate hikes, in my view, are underpriced. Inflationary pressures are going to continue to increase even as the Fed is hiking because they are a little bit behind the curve. And at some point, it's going to be an impact. And at that point, the Fed will have to hike more in order to kill off inflation.
I mean, this is intriguing because it certainly steps outside the box our guests here on the show have laid out for us. I mean, this is a very different perspective. And I'm curious as to what led you to this conclusion, because the general consensus that we've had here and we've heard over, let's say, the last 3 to 6 months is that we'll probably see a curtailing of the hawkishness at the Fed. We'll see a little bit more dovish Fed as soon as maybe mid next year. And you seem to think that may not be the case, that Powell is not going to be like Bernanke, doesn't move as quickly, but might his tone change if U.S. equities continued to roll over at some point over that period? I mean, might Mnuchin not put some pressure on our current Fed head, perhaps change the direction of rates?
First, about pressure from the White House, probably more from Mr. President than...
He did appoint Mnuchin.
It is relevant. The tweeting is relevant. The cheapest Fed policy is one where a Fed official utters a few words and the market takes action. It's more expensive if you have to hike or lower rates. It's more expensive than that if you have to engage in quantitative easing and the like. And so when you have the Fed policy being torpedoed by somebody very influential, such as the president, odds are that the Fed will have to do more than it would otherwise have to do to achieve the same goal. And so the first time President Trump tweeted, the long bond sold off. The cost of borrowing rose when President Trump complained about rates going up. And that is the rational reaction in the market. When you have the interference from the executive, you will have to do more to achieve the same thing. And indeed, if you follow the scenario that I laid out, odds are that the tweeting is going to increase because it means that the Powell will have to increase into a slowing economy because inflationary pressures are going to move higher. Going back to one of the other things you said, you mentioned the equity market. Again, the Fed's role is not to manage the equity market. And I know a huge portion of your audience disagrees with it, and emotionally I also disagree with it. But historically, whenever the equity market has sold off, or not whenever, often when the equity market has sold off, it was because credit conditions got tighter, because suddenly the weak sectors of the economy didn't have access to credit anymore. And so there was a correlation there. That doesn't mean there's a causation. And the reason I say this is that it is perfectly possible for the equity market to plunge and the Fed not to act. The thing to watch is whether access to credit will be available. The Fed is a club of banks. The Fed's role role is not to save the equity market. The Fed's role is to save the banking system. They want credit in the economy. So you've got to put your credit hat on, your interest rate hat on. That's what the Fed is worried about. And whether or not the Fed is quote-unquote hawkish or not, the Fed is not hawkish. People, I listen to some of your programs, the Fed isn't hawkish. We have, the Powell himself says, we still have a stimulus in the economy. Now think about that. We are at record, almost record low employment. We have an economic stimulus, and the Fed has the foot on the accelerator. That makes no sense. That is not hawkish. The only hawkish thing he has said is that if inflation were to move higher, they are determined to do the right thing. Well, guess what? Yeah, that is hawkish, my goodness sake. I mean, it is not hawkish, even the rate hikes we've had. And the reason it isn't hawkish, because we have increasing wage inflation and the like. And at this stage, we have still had folks from the sidelines join the labor force. And nobody exactly knows when that's running out. In my view of the world, it's probably going to run out in a few months. But I don't know whether it's 2 months or 8 months. It's something I watch very closely. And there are several indicators that I'm watching as to when that might be at an end. And by the way, the reason we say and do all this thing is because historically in an economic downturn, the stock market performs poorly. Well, we've had 9 years of a bull run, right? The question is, how far do you want to push it to the edge before we are at the next recession, before it takes some chips off the table? But at the same time, my prediction is interest rates are going to move higher than currently priced into the market. And by the way, you can actually trade that directly. You have to use derivatives, but you can do that, and we have some positions on for that. But at the same time, I'd be very willing to flip that upside down once I think we see an economic downturn, because once we reach that point, the Fed, because they'll have overdone it, they have to tighten more aggressively, and they'll have to go all the way back down to zero and then some potentially in order to then undo it. And so we're going to be up for a wild ride. But not yet. At this stage, we have this Goldilocks world, and usually the time to get prepared for worse times is when things look great.
Okay, so let me speak on behalf of the astute listener. On the one hand, Axel Merck says, you know, we don't have a hawkish Fed, but we're seeing the balance sheet at the St. Louis Fed's website. We're seeing that balance sheet contract by as much as, I think you could argue, 5% recently. That's the biggest downturn in quite some time. Would you argue then, as some of our guests have, that this is likely just a sleight of hand, that in reality they haven't curtailed their purchases of mortgage-backed securities, CDSs, CDOs, and other toxic obligations? They maybe haven't curtailed that as much, or it's a non-event, because they are raising rates. That's technically hawkish, and they are contracting their balance sheet.
Well, if you take the plug out of the bathtub, at some point it's going to be dry, right? But in the beginning, you don't really notice it. And so by all means, yes, and by the way, the question is, where do we go, right? And the current constellation of the Fed is not going to go back down to a minimal balance sheet. They have pretty much agreed, they will manage interest rates by paying interest on excess reserves. And that's a whole discussion on its own. But even though we are draining liquidity from the system, we are draining excess reserves. And so right now, with this multi-trillion dollar balance sheet, the way that they're trying to slow down the economy is by paying banks boatloads, tens of billions, if not over 100 billion in money to incentivize them to not lend, says, hey, rather give the money to the Fed. And so all they're doing really is taking a little bit off the surface there. Now, at some point, it's going to have an impact. And at some point, the Fed will stop. For the time being, I agree with you. And yes, it's draining. And yes, the ECB is stopping to print money. And by the way, I think interest rate hikes also underpriced in the Eurozone. Eurozone is also going to stop printing money at the end of the year, is currently at least the expectation. The Bank of Japan has been printing much less than expected. So yes, all of that is going to be a headwind to risk assets. What I've been talking about is interest rates mostly, and interest rates in the U.S. will continue to move higher because inflationary pressures are increasing. At the same time, I've been arguing the Fed is behind the curve. And so even with those rate hikes, we are behind the curve. And that obviously creates some interesting dynamics. And I know there's a gold program in some ways, right? You look at a lot of gold. Why is it that gold has held up reasonably well despite all these rate hikes? And it is precisely because these rate hikes on a real basis aren't quite as significant as some people make it out to be.
Let me argue on behalf of Michael Pinto. He was one of our featured guests in the last show. Penta Economics brings up a really interesting, intriguing chart from Deutsche Bank. Deutsche Bank has outlined essentially the monetary operations of all the key leading central banks. I don't know, the BOJ, the BOE, the Fed, Beijing, and a few others. And they bring it together in a conglomerate. And it shows that for the first time, likely since the Great Recession, we are now either at the cusp or will be soon crossing that threshold into negative quantitative operations worldwide. Can you give us some quick thoughts there and then your parting thoughts, please?
Yes, I agree with all of that. By the way, we have a gazillion of charts at mercinvestments.com/research where you can dive into these as well, download them and slice and dice them as you wish. I do see stormy weather ahead for risk assets. The only thing I'm arguing is the Fed will continue marching. And to just, since your audience is interested in gold, the reason why gold may be worthwhile anyway is the biggest competitor to gold is real returns on cash. And I'm arguing that even with the higher rates, you're not getting a real return. And the other one is that as this happens, the other thing that happens is that volatility will come back into the market. The whole point of quantitative easing was to make risky assets appear less risky. Risk premia were compressed, meaning that this junk stuff didn't trade much of a premium. That process is in reverse, and that really applies to all risk assets. It means volatility is going to increase. And the reason why gold may be a good investment in that environment is because gold doesn't have a cash flow. Risk assets have a cash flow that gets bigger when volatility moves higher, when rates go higher. And that is why often in late stages of an economic cycle, gold can do quite well because gold doesn't have a cash flow. It's a boring brick after all, right? And so that's why in every bear market since the early 70s, with the exception of the early 80s bear market when Volcker induced very high real interest rates, gold performed very well. And so if you think real interest rates are going to go very high, then don't buy any gold. But otherwise, I always call it easiest diversifier. It doesn't always go up when the market goes down, but it's one of the few things that has a very low, if any, correlation to stocks, and that's how it helps diversify our portfolio, and that's why in an environment where it's very difficult to find a decent sort of diversification.
For our, you know, economic neophytes, I'd just like to simplify your last comment. While on the one hand, it appears as though the Fed and some of their colleagues are preparing to or are acting in this, you know, hawkish manner, tough on inflation, we're going to protect your purchasing power, we're here to defend our currencies, they're behind the curve as far as real interest rates and, more importantly, you know, the real return on your wealth, because the precious metals do not carry that yield, as you say. They are somewhat insulated, and they might be the go-to asset, whereas these higher flyers that had been, you know, loved by portfolio managers and money managers and institutions might lose favor, and even if just a little modicum of that were to flow into the metals. Katie, bar the doors there. As we wrap up, if you wouldn't mind telling folks a bit more about this neat charity event, I'm sure there's a couple other takeaway points you'd like to leave with the listeners.
Well, for our investment discussion and race, go to mercinvestments.com/walkthetalk. Otherwise, just go to the website, mercinvestments.com, learn about us, follow me on Twitter, on LinkedIn, whatever your favorite places. We try to be maybe soon back on your program.
So we're going to make sure to make these links readily available, you know, on our email blasts as well as on the GoldSeek, you know, network for all our listeners. And again, everybody in Atlanta, Charlotte, Raleigh, Greenville, Asheville, what's your excuse? You don't have one. Even DC, be sure and head to this because they're being very gracious and offering this to the public. And you can even help, you know, it's a worthy cause. So there's your excuse to your better half on the 20th of this month. You certainly don't want to miss this. It sounds like a lot of fun. Axel Merck, we'll have you back on soon, hopefully.
My pleasure.
This is Robert Ian with GoldSeek.com Radio. As we approach the final chapter of another year, the acknowledged federal debt is nearing $22 trillion. 1 year ago, on December 11th, 2017, Dr. Mark Skidmore from Michigan State University announced that he and a group of graduate students had found an additional $21 trillion of unauthorized spending in the Departments of Defense and Housing and Urban Development for the years ranging from 1998 to 2015. When you add those debts together, you arrive at nearly $43 trillion of debt. And that doesn't even begin to include all the off-budget obligations that this generation and future generations are obligated to pay. Debt, without the required level of production to support that debt, is unsustainable. And more dramatic wealth transfers will occur from the accounts of the many into the accounts of the few, just like in 2008. The games being played by the Federal Reserve with the continuous interest rate hikes are clearly political. The idea of raising interest rates and skimming the productive effort off the top in this currently and possibly temporary productive environment is just like the bookie or agent who takes a bigger and bigger cut. Instead of taking a small or smaller slice of more economic activity and growing the base for everyone. You can see that skimming taking place in the stock market. Yes, it's down from its recent highs as new money has come in, possibly from your pensions. Wall Street and insiders have been selling off their earlier investments, for example in Facebook, and cashing in at the peak before Atlas decides to shrug again. Debt is the nemesis. Guard against it at all costs. Debt-based Ponzi schemes, regardless of what form they take, whether it be in the stock market, the real estate market, or other boom and bust cycles managed by Fed intervention. Guard against them at all cost. Avoid the hype. And you may come out all right in 2019. Because 2008 never really ended. And that's going to become painfully obvious very soon. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com. Thanks, Chris.
Okay, Robert, thanks for another excellent installment. Well, that wraps up this week's GoldSeek.com radio episode. For two new big guests, be sure to check out next week's show. Until we talk to you again, have a great week.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.